Welcome to The Whole View. I'm Stacey Toth of RealEverything.com. I'm all about loving the skin you're in and being healthy inside and out.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Ballantyne of ThePaleoMom.com. I believe that scientific literacy is the key to improving public health.
Welcome back to The Whole View, episode 425. This week, we are diving in. Is this part four?
Yeah.
Of our coronavirus discussion. If you haven't yet heard previous episodes, we talk a lot in a timeline progression, obviously, about what is happening in the state of the world. I will say today is October 7th, 2020. I give you that context because things are changing all the time, and it's important for you to know what day it is. I think it'll be an interesting one for me, for context for our listeners. If you hadn't heard, my family, specifically my husband and I, both had COVID, was it April?
I was going to say May.
Yeah, I had a hard time keeping track. It's just that part of my life where I'm like, yep, that was a long time ago.
I would literally have to go look at the timestamp of our Stacey Has COVID show.
Yeah. And we did do a show on that. And I also have a detailed blog post going through the timeline. I don't want to revisit that, but I tell you because it's relative to some of the long-term effects, side effects, and different things that probably come up on this show. But before we dig in, we have something positive to start the show because we're always seeking opportunities to find positivity in 2020.
We have this wonderful message from Terry, who's one of our new patrons on Patreon. And I wanted to read this just because it's lovely feedback. But also I wanted to, in case some of our listeners don't know, we have a Patreon account and you can support us by becoming a member. And we provide, we're just switching to bonus audio on a weekly basis on Patreon. That is a like behind the scenes, what we really think for each episode. So this is what Terry wrote. She wrote, "Longtime listener here, and I adore the Patreon content. I wondered if it would be short content, but knowing you, why would I have thought that? You give so much, and the Patreon episodes are no different. I utterly loved the first two episodes and really enjoyed hearing about your move from identifying as paleo and the changes in the paleo community, especially around racial justice and anti-science. I'm a Whole30 coach and share your articles and podcasts with my clients so frequently. I also help moderate a Whole30 Facebook group of around 4,000, over 50, mostly women. And when it's my turn to moderate, I frequently have Science Week. And guess who is featured prominently each time?" I don't know. Who do you think she features, Stacey?
I think it might be us. Specifically you.
"I adore science, the friendly chat, the laughs, and the tips. Truly, this new Patreon content is a bright gift in this very dark time. Thank you both."
Oh, thank you, Terry.
So for our listeners, if you want to join our Patreon family, you can find us at patreon.com/thewholeview. We always have links in our show notes as well. And go check it out. We have bonus audio there now weekly, and it's unfiltered. So we work hard to keep our podcast rated G so that you can listen to it in the car with the kids. We always warn you if we're going to cover a more adult topic that you may not want to listen to with your kids running around in the background, but that's not the case with Patreon. The Patreon is not for little ears.
Although Sarah has recently moved to stopping cursing in general, and she shares the weirdest alternative terms. So if you're curious and want to be creative, you know where to go.
So as we dig into some more COVID topics, you know, today we're really going to talk about, you know, Stacey, I know this has been something that you have been experiencing, the sort of long tail of symptoms after COVID infection. So we're going to talk about sort of the reinfection stories that have made the news lately. We're going to talk about long haulers. And we're also going to talk about some of the potential long-term effects that's sort of different from prolonged infection. But before we sort of get into these topics, I want to briefly summarize a lot of the COVID topics that we've already covered on the podcast so that our listeners can go back and listen to those episodes if they missed them. So our first COVID-19 FAQ show was episode 396. This was early on, so we talked about what was known at the time about the epidemiology, the disease itself, why it was important to take the coronavirus shutdown seriously. We talked about autoimmune disease and COVID-19. We talked about antibacterial soaps versus natural soaps, the health effects of disinfectant. And this is as we were all washing high-touch surfaces in our home daily very early on. We talked about the evidence and efficacy or lack thereof for silver-containing solutions to myth bust those. We talked about elderberry for autoimmune disease or for anyone, and the again, myth-busting the stories that have sort of warned against elderberry for potential increasing cytokine storms. And then we talked about vitamin C, vitamin D, and zinc in that episode. So it was a wide-ranging introduction to COVID-19. In episode 401, we talked about what's our way out of this pandemic, you know, how do we get back to life as normal? We talked about a little bit about reinfection cases. We're going to talk about that in more depth today. And we talked about face masks and the science behind them. In episode 412, we talked about how isolation may impact immune function and some of the, again, sort of myth-busting some of the concerns that have been around that. We also talked about isolation and how it might impact the microbiome. We talked about public health messaging. We went into depth about vitamin D and COVID and the huge importance of addressing vitamin D insufficiency to help reduce the risk of COVID. And we talked a little bit about post-COVID effects, which of course we're going to go into a lot more detail today. So today we're really going to hone in on, especially now that there's a lot more data on reinfection versus reactivation, on long haulers, or sometimes called long COVID, and as well as the sort of long-term complications and damage as, you know, unfortunately, another thing that we need to think about as we are making choices in our lives in terms of what level of precautions we're going to take.
As you know, Sarah, because of how many text I've sent you, this has been an ongoing thing for me. And I think I even said it on the podcast long, long ago. I said, I know for a fact that we are going to find two things at the time that were not known. One, that there is an effect on the brain, which has since been shown. And two, that there is a hormonal impact to this, because I told you specifically, I had noticed two menstrual cycles in a row at that time, and now I've had more since, that I get symptoms reactivated during that time period. And specifically, I experience inflammation, and whether it's activating a autoimmune disease or whether it's brain fog on its own, because my thyroid effect could also be that. It is very obvious to me that that is what is happening when I both ovulate and have my menstruation. There's like different kind of symptoms, but they come back with both of those kind of hormonal cycles. And when you and I were talking about it, obviously months ago, there wasn't as much known as there is now. And to me, I've just felt like it's really important to talk about this, because I think, you know, there's so much focus on, for example, how many people have died. As someone who has gone through this and is living with the side effects now, there's millions of people. I mean, I'm not even counted in that 7+ million number, because my husband was the one that got the test, because it was so early on, I couldn't even get a test. And so here I am, I'm like not even contributing to one of those numbers. And I'm one of the lucky ones, I feel like, right? I got a mild case, and I could not be more grateful for how fortunate our family was at how we reacted. But at the same time, I'm like, here I am, what, like months later, and I'm still feeling the effects. And it's frustrating to know how many millions of people out there could be experiencing that. And I think that it's important that we acknowledge it. And we also, you know, kind of think about as a community, this not just being like the flu. It's not something you get and then you're done and you have immunity for a short amount of time until the next strain comes out. And then whatever it is, like this is showing different changes in how it's playing out in our body. And I think you discussing the science of that will be really helpful for people.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is one of the things, again, we sort of touched on it in a few early episodes because we were seeing these anecdotal reports come in. We're now at a point where there's actually some, you know, case series. There's some more epidemiological studies and there's more research really trying to look at, it's a spectrum, right? So it's all the way from something that looks like persistent infection all the way to something that looks like maybe a triggering of a new or a latent autoimmune disease, and then all the way to like organ damage that is as a direct result of the infection. And they're all sort of what they all kind of fall under the umbrella of is long-term impact. And it's really important to understand what the long-term impact of this is so that we could, for example, be monitoring people who've had COVID for potential cardiovascular complications in the future. I mean, there's certainly some evidence that makes that look like that could be something that needs to just start being part of, like, you know, you go for your physical every year and 10, 20 years from now, there's this, you know, people who've had COVID have to have this separate extra tests in order to monitor something, right? So we might be looking at developing some kind of preventative care around potential increased risk for future complications. But it also has implications for the economy. If you're talking about several million people with brain fog, like that impacts productivity, right? So there's all of these downstream effects that, you know, we need to really understand and be able to wrap our heads around, because it's at this point, you know, there's still a lot of work that needs to be done to reduce the spread and control. You know, we are at a really high level of new cases every day, and a high enough level with high enough community spread that it makes any kind of gathering, right? It makes schools really challenging. It makes church services really challenging. It makes weddings and funerals really challenging. Like there's no normal with regards to gatherings, right? The community spread is too high. The chances of there being somebody in a gathering of 100 people who has it is nearly 100% in most places in the country right now. And so as we're trying to figure out, you know, how to have, you know, continue with precautions, right? So increase how widespread mask use is, continue to socially distance, continue to avoid gatherings, continue to practice good hygiene, hand washing, all of those things, while, you know, there's still research ongoing in terms of preventatives as well as therapies. We also need to understand this whole other side of this virus, which is not related to the 2 to 3 weeks of active infection. So let's start with reinfection and whether or not the recent reports that look like reinfection are true reinfection or reactivation, and where the scientists are on this right now.
Yes. Please. This is, you know, this is my paranoid.
I know.
How many times have I asked you about this? I'm like, what's the science say? Is there an update? What are you seeing?
It's just a few dozen. It's fine. Well, and I know that this is something that is very, very concerning for a lot of people, because one of the things we want to know is, if I've had it, how careful do I need to be? Does it mean that I'm immune? Or is this going to be a situation where I'm actually more susceptible to a reinfection? Or how long is my immunity going to last? And this is because there is something called antibody-dependent enhancement of infection, or ADE, sometimes ADI, antibody-dependent infection. And we know that this occurs in other viruses. So it happens in influenza A virus. It happens in Coxsackie virus. It happens in RSV virus, in Ebola, in HIV, and in dengue virus. And actually, dengue fever is probably the best understood in terms of the mechanism. So in dengue fever, there's four known strains of the virus. And if you get one strain, you get dengue fever, your body mounts an immune response. You are then protected for a relatively short period of time against not just the strain you just had, but the other three strains. Then as antibodies fall, there's this window of time where if you get exposed to one of the other three strains, you can have a way more severe case. And it's life-threatening. It's really bad. And then if you don't get exposed to one of the other three strains in that window of time, then, and you go even farther out where you have like no antibodies left, you're still immune against the first strain you had. But if you get one of the other three strains, then it's just dengue fever all over again. So there's this magic sweet spot of a low but not zero level of antibodies that actually magnifies the infection. And the way that's working, the critical mechanism to understand, is that the dengue fever virus actually replicates inside immune cells, macrophages, monocytes, and dendritic cells. And so those are all cells that eat things that are tagged with antibodies. So you have your B cells that go around your body, they make antibodies. When you get an infection, they spew out, they turn into antibody factories, they spew out and release tons of antibodies into your body. Those antibodies find the foreign invader, in this case, right, it'd be dengue virus, attached to it, and then that helps macrophages and monocytes. These are the eater cells, right? They're called phagocytic cells. So they're the cells that come around and like engulf a bad thing by wrapping its membrane around it and internalizing it. These eater cells detect dengue virus because it's tagged with the antibody. So what happens is when there's high levels of antibodies shortly after infection, they're able to neutralize the virus. When there's low levels of antibodies, they are not sufficient to neutralize the three strains that you were not exposed to yet, but they are sufficient to tag it for macrophages to actually act like a back door so that they can more efficiently infect the immune cells that this particular virus infects. And so this is where dengue fever has this antibody-dependent enhancement of infection. Again, it's sort of in this like antibody sweet spot, which roughly correlates to a few months out from infection and lasting up to about a year after infection. So there's, with dengue fever, this is how ADE works. And it's good to know that it's not, it's probably not something that we're going to see in COVID, because COVID does not appear to be very good at infecting immune cells. It can get in there, but it doesn't replicate very effectively in immune cells. So because of that very important difference in what cell type the virus is infecting and replicating in, right now, we don't have any evidence of antibody-dependent enhancement of infection with SARS-CoV-2. Now, that being said, with SARS-CoV, the most closely related coronavirus to the virus causing COVID-19, which is the virus that was responsible for the SARS epidemic in 2002 and 2003, we do know that in the early vaccine development with that virus, there was what's called vaccine-enhanced infection, which is typically through a similar mechanism to antibody-dependent enhancement of infection. So that's a little piece to sort of hold and go, okay, you know, just because it's not great at replicating in immune cells, at this point, this isn't impossible. We don't have a firm, no, this will never happen with COVID. But what we do have is we have really only a few dozen confirmed cases in the medical literature of what looks like reinfection with COVID. Now, this might just be that we haven't, you know, the pandemic is not even a year old. We know, so there are seven different coronaviruses that infect humans. There's the coronavirus responsible for COVID, the coronavirus that was responsible for the MERS, Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome epidemic in 2009, I think. And then the coronavirus responsible for the SARS epidemic in 2002, 2003. And then there's four coronaviruses that are known to cause the common cold. And together, they're responsible for somewhere between a quarter and a third of common colds that circulate annually. And there's research showing that our immunity to these common cold coronaviruses doesn't last all that long, maybe as little as a year. So there was a study done in the late 1980s where they took 15 volunteers, they sequestered them. These volunteers agreed to have the most well-studied common cold-causing coronavirus injected up their noses. And then they were sort of isolated so that you're not getting exposed to anything else. And then the researchers looked to see if they got infected. So of the 15 that got the virus shot up their noses, 10 of them were infected and 8 of them displayed symptoms. So 2 people had an asymptomatic infection, basically. And that's, you know, measured by recovering virus particles from their noses with a swab. The researchers then took blood tests regularly, looked at the level of antibodies, and kind of like what we're seeing with COVID, right? We're seeing a spike in antibodies that starts a few weeks after infection and then slowly comes down after a few months. That's not the only way that our immune systems can remember an infection, but it is one of our main, you know, tools. Is we produce what are called memory B cells, and they can ramp up antibodies the next time we're exposed to something pretty quickly, and antibodies will circulate in our body for a long time. It's really dependent on how the immune system is activated in response to an infection, and coronaviruses, it turns out, are pretty good at manipulating our initial immune reactions. So they kind of have these ways of hiding from our immune systems. And so what they did with these 15 people, 14 of them came back after a year and they agreed to have more virus shot up their noses. So of the original 10 who had been infected the first time around, 6 of them became infected a year later, but none of them actually developed symptoms. So they were all asymptomatic carriers. Given that, you know, what that means is there's partial immunity, right? So there's enough immunity that your immune system is on top of this second infection enough that you don't have symptoms, but you're infectious. And this is really, really important in the context of COVID, because if this is something that could happen, and maybe it's not a year, maybe it's 2 years or 4 years or 5 years. And with SARS, which is the most similar coronavirus to the SARS-CoV-2 virus, the one that causes COVID-19, we have reason to think that maybe immunity is a little bit better than the common cold coronaviruses. But if you might be able to become infectious and asymptomatic later on, it means that there's it's going to become increasingly difficult to manage without widespread, frequent testing where we're just patrolling the general community to look for cases. And it means that as somebody who hasn't had it, as time goes on, the proportion of people walking around who are asymptomatic carriers could go from right now, where we think it's around maybe 20% of people are asymptomatic. About 40% of spread right now is a combination of asymptomatic and pre-symptomatic, right? So people who don't have symptoms and have no idea that they're sick. So we could be going from that percentage to something that's even scarier. And so understanding, even if you're immune enough to not get a symptomatic infection upon a subsequent exposure, you may have a higher likelihood of being an asymptomatic carrier. And that is really, really important for us to understand. There's been some other studies that have looked at common cold coronaviruses and have shown that the reinfection times, there was a study actually that followed 10 healthy men for 35 years. And for part of that 35 years, they were getting blood samples every 3 months and for part of it every 6 months. And they looked at antibodies to common cold coronaviruses. And basically every time those antibodies spiked, assumed that that was a recent infection. And then they would kind of watch them come down. And they showed basically that the most common interval for reinfection was 12 months, but it ranged anywhere between 6 months and 105 months, right? So almost 8 years, but that, you know, that's kind of like the window of immunity for common cold coronaviruses. With the SARS epidemic in 2002, 2003, and again, like SARS is about 80% the same, the SARS-CoV versus SARS-CoV-2, right? So these, in the coronavirus family, these two viruses are the most similar. Are the virus that causes COVID-19 is 50% or less similar to the other, in terms of genome sequence, to the other coronaviruses. So when we look at the data that we have from SARS, that's the most probably relevant. And there were a few studies that showed that immunity for the people who were infected, and granted, it was really different in terms of a pandemic because people were not contagious until about 24 hours after symptoms started, which is very different than COVID-19, where you're most contagious about 20 hours before your symptoms start, but you might be contagious 2 or 3 days before symptoms. So that makes this a much more challenging virus because it's just so much more easily spread. SARS, for us, had a much higher mortality rate, but it was just, even though it was infectious, there was this window of time to test and isolate. That was why it never became widespread in the community. So with SARS, the studies that looked at memory showed similar, right? Antibodies would kind of spike for a few months and come down. And we had this sort of similar, like, oh, like, does this mean our immune systems aren't remembering it? But what researchers discovered was that the memory was actually driven by T cells, not B cells. So B cells are our, like, antibody factory cells. T cells are like our micromanager, like our middle management of the immune system. And there are certain types of T cells that are responsible for activating B cells. And there are certain types of T cells that are responsible for detecting virally infected cells in your body and basically forcing those cells to commit cell suicide so that other immune cells, which T cells also micromanage, can come in and clean it up. And so T cell mediated responses are just a little bit different, and it's harder to measure. It requires more sophisticated equipment. We don't patrol for memory T cells the same way we can easily measure for antibodies. But it looks like the main memory for the SARS-CoV virus was driven by T cells. So it's less like a cellular memory as opposed to an antibody memory. And that was lasting more like 2 to 3 years. One study showed up to about 6 years. They could still, you know, show that there was at least partial immunity at 6 years to SARS. So all of this taken together shows us that reinfection is something that we may need to be concerned about, but there's not mechanistically a good argument for thinking that we're going to see it this early. So what's happened here is that there's a few dozen cases that they tested, they were sick, they went home, they tested negative, then weeks or a couple months later, they test positive again, they're sicker again. Some are similarly sick the second time, Some are more sick the second time. Some are asymptomatic the second time. What is this? Is this true reinfection? And right now, the researchers who have really tried to examine it, nobody is convinced that it's true reinfection. Now, this is also because none of these cases that have really like made the news are immunocompromised people. So for immunocompromised people, that's a separate group of people. For those people, reinfection is a legitimate concern. That is a whole separate, right? That's somebody with HIV AIDS, right? That is a whole separate group. That's not people with autoimmune disease. That is people who are on really strong immunosuppressing drugs, people in active cancer treatment. That's a group of people who know that they're immunocompromised and they're super susceptible to infection. That is a separate group of people than what we're seeing in these few dozen reinfection cases. What is a likely better explanation for what is going on with these cases that look like reinfection at this point is that it's viral reactivation, which means they're long haulers who had a latent period and then combined with testing limitations and failures. So our tests, depending on what test is done, have a fairly high false negative rate. And you just have to have a certain amount of virus in the right spot that's being sampled correctly in order to test positive. So it may be that those negative tests weren't true negatives in the middle. And it was sort of combined with, basically you could think of it this way, like the immune system almost beat it, but didn't. And then the immune system is like, you know, it's like an immune system that thought it did a good job, but it didn't really. So it goes, okay, we're done. Everyone pack up and go home. And then the virus like comes out after hiding behind the tree and is like, ha ha ha, and replicates. And that's where you get this like second spike. So
I hope someone makes like a cartoon YouTube video to explain what you just said.
I'm picturing like an evil virus with legs and arms hiding behind a tree, waiting for the immune systems with their like, you know, backpacks, like time to go home, boys. And then
I have totally like magic school bus scene for me. I saw the whole thing play out.
This is probably more likely what's going on. And so the data that points to this explanation is that we've seen, there's a really wide range in how long people have measurable virus in their systems. So there may not be infectious. That virus might be dead. So you might be shedding dead virus after that, 10-day period. But we can still measure it. And combined with, we know these viruses are really good at hiding. They manipulate our immune systems and they hide. And actually, they may be able to hide out within our cells. So we still don't even understand, there's a ton of different viruses that once you have it, right? Herpes virus, for example, once you have it, it is there at all times. And as soon as you get stressed or don't sleep enough, it flares. And we don't understand yet if COVID may be able to do that in some people. So we don't understand if COVID is a virus that can hide out and go, ha ha, nobody's paying attention to me. And you, by the way, pulled an all-nighter for your work deadline. So now I'm back. So that is completely a more plausible explanation right now than true reinfection. And so, data has shown, right, some people have shown viral shedding as much as 83 days out from the first day of symptoms. And these have been measured in various clinical trials. There's been 10 days, 27 days, 37 days, 53 days. It is about 10%. Of patients who go to the hospital and get discharged are still shedding virus even after, say, being in the hospital for a prolonged period of time. And so we know that at least some people, it's taking more than a couple of weeks for the immune system to fully do the job of getting rid of all the virus. And so that leaves this window of time where if there's a few live viral particles, there's the opportunity for what is technically called reactivation, right? So the virus isn't fully gone, but maybe your immune system got rid of enough of it that you're feeling better, and then it's able to reactivate. And that is what, you know, the majority of scientists who are studying these cases believe is the actual explanation. Another possible explanation for what look like reinfections is genetic mutations causing new strains. And there's certainly a lot of scientists who are monitoring all of the various single nucleotide polymorphisms in the novel coronavirus to be able to monitor it for mutations that might have a diverging strain. Right now, even though there's tons of variants, right, you keep hearing about the variant that is, you know, in Europe versus the variant in China, they're not different enough to be considered different strains. You know, a variant can be as different as one nucleotide difference, right? So, and so right now, the science has shown that there's lots of variants, but none of them appear to be functionally different. So the news stories that have said, oh, and this one's way worse or way better or whatever, that's not actually supported by the science right now. And certainly right now, we are dealing with one strain of SARS-CoV-2. But that is something, again, you know, to keep an eye on. And when it comes to a new strain, the likelihood is it'll be a couple of people in one cluster somewhere that will show it as a reinfection, and then it'll need to be sequenced, and then scientists will see that it's a new strain. It's important to emphasize that this virus actually has a way of proofreading itself when it's replicating itself using our cellular machinery. And so because of that, it's not mutating very quickly. It doesn't mutate as anywhere near as fast as, for example, influenza. So we don't have a reason to suspect that we're going to be developing new strains of this during this pandemic. But it is something that over time, there is a possibility. So that is something, again, sort of keep in mind, but it's not a super likely explanation for this. So really what we're talking about, the most likely explanation for what look like reinfection cases is the fact that this virus is very good at manipulating, especially our initial immune responses. So what it does is it interferes with a group of cytokines called interferons. And it basically makes it so that as our immune system detects a virus and makes interferons, which is how it tells the rest of the immune system, oh my gosh, I found something bad, everyone come help. The virus itself is basically making it so the interferons can't deliver the message. And that's really important because interferon signaling basically turns on our antiviral defenses, of which we have, you know, many, right? There's many different ways that our immune system can protect ourselves against viruses, but those are turned on by interferons. And so this is really in the first few, probably like 2 to 7 days of infection. And it's one of the reasons why this infection you can sort of feel good for 4 or 5 days or up to 7 days. And then all of a sudden, things can take a pretty bad turn. And it's because the first part of the immune system, the quick acting innate immune system, is basically getting suppressed directly by the virus. And so the virus gets a head start replicating itself before the adaptive immune system, which is really specific and is what makes the antibodies and T cells and B cells are all part of the adaptive immune system. Basically, the virus gets a head start replicating itself before the adaptive immune system gets turned on and can come help out. And then we know that it can potentially hide out in a type of vesicle inside cells called exosomes. So these are like little tiny bubbles. You know, within a membrane within a cell. And we just don't know what its viability is inside those exosomes, how long it can hide there, how well it can hide from immune detection, especially once the adaptive immune system is turned on. So it's more likely that These are our long haulers who had a latent period. And really what all of this data points to, and we'll put links to the studies in the show notes. It means that herd immunity through natural infection is unlikely. So one of the interesting implications of this research is that we may be able to achieve a more lasting immunity through vaccination than through natural infection, because with a vaccination, there's nothing in that vaccine that's interfering with interferon signaling. So you're not getting the part where the virus is manipulating the immune reaction, so you can have a more robust immune response and therefore have a more lasting immunological memory to the infection. It also means it's highly likely that even once a effective and safe vaccine is developed, that boosters will be chronically, like whether they're every year or every 5 years, that boosters will likely be required in order to really, eradicate. That's what we want to do, right? We want to eradicate COVID. Like smallpox is gone, we want COVID to be gone. And given what we know about other coronaviruses and how long our immunity lasts, the only way to do that may be with boosters and even potentially with continued precautions like testing and contact tracing and maybe mask use for still a while, right? That really depends on exactly how effective a vaccine is and how well it's rolled out and what the environment is around that. And we'll definitely cover that once there's data to cover on an episode. But there's some really important implications of this research in terms of controlling the pandemic and what our way out is if we really need to understand how long our immunity is going to last. Unfortunately, we just won't know until we get to the point where people who had it early on, who are being monitored for their immunological memory, have had it long enough to no longer have immunological memory, right? That's how these things are studied. So there's a lot of questions here that researchers are trying to answer, but that we won't really have answers for maybe years.
It's interesting because I've heard so many different things around what's best and what's coming, and all of it really is conjecture until we really do know more, like you're saying. And what we do know works right now is social distancing and mask use and hand washing and all the things that we talked about kind of back on the original show. And it's interesting to kind of hear where we are in the process, and we've learned so much more, but as we've talked about the scientific method, we know that we're in the middle of this, right? Like we're not, we don't have the solution. We don't know everything yet. We won't know until much further in the future, because as you mentioned, like this idea that we could see people more prone to heart attacks, for example, is something that like, okay, that's concerning. That's not something I'm excited to hear, but it's super good to know that so that then health professionals can, like you said, screen for, plan for, prepare, maybe come up with a solution, or you know what I mean, like whatever that looks like. But we have to just keep being open to learning about this and making decisions like, okay, we understand it now, we're done learning, doesn't help anybody, right? Like we have to continue to become educated and engaged in the process.
And I recognize, in full disclosure for our listeners, we've had this podcast on the docket for about 2 months. And I was just not in a place where I was ready to dive into the literature in this level of depth to be able to pull together this information for this podcast, because I completely recognize like just being over it, like really, missing so many aspects of pre-pandemic life and sometimes just needing to like tune out the news and like just, right? Like it's almost like I want to just, put my hands over my ears and go, nah, 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 I can't hear you. And I really resonate with that. Just need for a break. I know that a lot of this data that we're sharing today, and we're still going to get into long haulers and long-term complications. Like I want to acknowledge right now for our listeners that this doesn't feel like good news, right? It doesn't, this is not a enjoyable, wow, I didn't know that. And look, I'm going to eat more broccoli, right? This is not one of those podcast episodes.
I mean, still eat a variety of fruits and vegetables.
Yeah, broccoli is still great. So I do sort of want to acknowledge it. I think, you know, I'm going to share what I hope the main take home is right now. I know we'll come back to this in the podcast. But the main message that this scientific research has for me is that the efforts that I am going into to protect myself and my family, take ourselves out of the pool of possible spreaders by social distancing and, you know, mainly staying in our homes and wearing masks whenever we're out of our homes and hand washing and all of those things that we're doing are still really important to do. And it's really important, as much as we're tired of them, to not let our guards down. And we're definitely at a point where we need to, find the communal strength to keep doing these things that right now, I mean, the data, even compared to when we covered masks on the show before, the data on masks just gets stronger and stronger and stronger. We really know that that is our number one best tool for slowing the spread. And so, sneak peek to the take-home messages at the end of this podcast. That's where we're heading. But I really want to talk about long haulers, especially the stories from long haulers and the numbers of long haulers in terms of anecdotes is increasing. We're starting to get some studies that are looking at them. Some medical professionals who are starting to specialize in treating long haulers. And especially given that that's the most likely explanation for what looks like reinfection, I feel like it's really important to really dig into this, because it is potentially a huge percentage of people who are getting COVID, who are getting what they're calling either long haulers, COVID long haulers, or long COVID. Studies are showing that, this is just a long infection. I mean, period. About 30% of people still have symptoms after 3 weeks, and about 10% of people still have symptoms at about 2 months. And right around 10% is where they think of symptomatic cases, is where they think long haulers are right now. That's sort of where the data is pointing. Of course, there's more epidemiological studies than this is required, because also not all long haulers are seeking medical attention, right? Like if your long haul symptoms are tolerable, you might not be wanting to do a whole trip to your doctor's office and all of the things that entails during a pandemic.
I haven't talked to a medical professional about the symptoms I'm experiencing. Right.
And the symptoms, the most common symptoms are, right, and this is from studies that have looked at this, the number one most common is fatigue. But some people are having ongoing shortness of breath. Some people are having ongoing joint pain, muscle pain, body aches. And then brain fog and difficulty concentrating are also very, very common symptoms reported by long haulers. There's some other ones that are less common, like chest pain and headaches and gastrointestinal issues. But generally, something that almost looks like chronic fatigue syndrome is the most common sort of symptom collection that is being reported. And for some of these people, they report having felt better for a few weeks and then relapsing, and other people don't ever have that latency period. And that, again, strengthens the case for the very small number of reports that look like reinfection actually being long haulers. There's a lot more reports of long haulers than there are of reports that look like reinfection. And there's some researchers who are actually suggesting that this is chronic fatigue syndrome that is triggered by COVID infection. So chronic fatigue syndrome is an autoimmune disease that has a very high occurrence rate of being triggered by infection. With autoimmune disease, taking a step backwards, about a third of our risk factors are a genetic. So basically, you've got a collection of genes. There's many, many genes that can increase risk of autoimmune disease. It's usually a collection of them. that would increase risk. And then the other two-thirds comes from exposures, diet, lifestyle, and there's often a triggering event. So you basically create this like perfect storm of situation, right? Some nutrient deficiencies, some high stress, some not enough sleep, some poor gut health, along with a genetic predisposition, and then you add a trigger. And sometimes that trigger is a super stressful event, but a common trigger for autoimmune disease is infection. So we know, for example, that about 75% of chronic fatigue syndrome is actually infection triggered. The most common is Epstein-Barr virus, the virus responsible for mononucleosis. But we might be adding SARS-CoV-2 to the list. So there are some researchers who think that what is happening in long haulers is not necessarily continued infection so much as the infection kind of melding into chronic fatigue syndrome. Another possible explanation for long haulers beyond, you know, it's just taking that long for the body's immune system to fight off this virus is tissue or organ damage that takes a long time to heal. We know microclots are a big factor in how this virus is damaging our body. And we know that that is probably what's driving the pneumonia that COVID causes, but also the other tissue damage that we'll talk about. So that's also a possibility that depending on exactly how the immune system damaged things or those microclots, that is what's driving symptoms. But we also know that there's a thing that they're calling multisystem inflammatory syndrome. They've just, it was initially identified in children that it sort of looks like Kawasaki disease, but they now have enough cases in adults. So they're calling it Miss C or Miss A. And it is typically this happens in people who've had COVID and recovered from COVID. And then they have this, like, it's a life-threatening, it's treatable, but it is a very severe inflammatory syndrome that's happening later. And, you know, clinical features can include things like really high elevated inflammatory markers that is causing things like shock, cardiac dysfunction, abdominal pain. It can cause thrombosis, which is basically throwing blood clots, acute liver injury. And so this is a potentially, it's possible that this is a severe form of an inflammatory condition or like a long stimulus of the immune system, right? Dysfunctional immune response, because COVID is manipulating how our immune systems respond to it, that in its severe form is this multi-system inflammatory syndrome, and in its minor form is long haulers. So that's, and where the line is between something like this and chronic fatigue syndrome, like any autoimmune disease that is also caused by immune dysfunction, that might be a very blurry line. So we've got, you know, it could be that this multi-system inflammatory syndrome in children or adults is like a super flare of whatever this autoimmune disease is that's potentially being triggered by COVID. So these are all possible explanations for long haulers. Right now, you know, the way this is being treated is symptom relief, and you know, it's whether it's continued infection by the virus or something like chronic fatigue syndrome. You know, rest and reducing stress and nutrient density and hydration, check vitamin D levels and make sure they're dialed in. Like all of those things are still the action items, right? There's not, at this point, there's not a therapy that has been created to address what's going on with these long haulers.
Womp, womp.
Mm-hmm. I know.
To be fair, one of the reasons this has been on the docket for a long time is also because my fragile ego and how many times we've been like, okay, Stacey, just prepare yourself. You might not be excited about the show. And I think, you know, for me, it's difficult because you talk about these things and just like you're saying, it's could it be this? Could it be this? We don't know. Ultimately, I know what I need to be doing to help myself feel better, as you pointed out. And I think what's difficult is that until we know more, until we understand more, and the science can catch up with medical solutions, like we know what we need to do to prevent it, we also know the best things that we can do on the back end. And the other thing that I'll mention that wasn't in your list, but that I've been trying to really focus on, is not drinking alcohol. We know that drinking alcohol can exacerbate it on the front end. And I know for me, that really helps my, that prevents my body from detoxing properly. I already have.
And it also suppresses immune function and drives gut dysbiosis. I mean, alcohol is really like the opposite of what is good to support immune function.
And I think what's sad is that that is something that we're all feeling openly. I had a drink two nights ago and it was like a thing. Like I was like, I am going to have a drink. Like it's, I'm going to do it and I'm going to be aware of it. And all it took was like half of a drink. And I was like, okay. But it's so hard. Like you said, like we're all exhausted of this. And the idea that it could be, I read yesterday, as late as November 2021 before there's a vaccine that's ready for children, which means my kids could potentially be home not just all this year, but start school next year virtually as well. Yeah. Like it's overwhelming and it's anxiety and it's so hard. And so many of us are just over it. But I just want to remind you that like alcohol doesn't actually make anything feel better, right? Like you might, it might take an edge off and you might feel better in that moment, but it doesn't help us learn to cope with the frustrations that we're having or communicate in a healthy way with, you know, those that we can, whether it's virtually or in our family or whatever it is. And I just, I'm just going to get on a little bit of a mental health soapbox for a minute, because I think, you know, we're talking about all of the physical things that's happening with this, and whether you have had COVID or not had COVID, there is emotions and mental health at play from the anxiety of it all. And, you know, for me, my, I've had several people say to me like, why do you even care? Like you had it before. I'm like, well, I don't know that I can't get it again and that I won't get it even worse. Like, I don't, you know what I mean? Like, I don't know that for sure. Even if the science is predominantly looking a certain sort of way, it does, it's not to my benefit. And furthermore, as you noted, what if I did get it again and I didn't know and I was asymptomatic and then I was going around spreading it, right? So it's like, we, no matter where you are in this process, you're either, you know, had it or not had it. There is no solution for any of us. And we're all in this together is the only thing that I can offer as a solution, right? Like you're not alone. You are not the only one feeling frustrated and exhausted and over it and ready for change. Like everyone, we're on the same team. Unfortunately, that team is not winning right now, but we are strategically working on a comeback.
Oh yeah. I mean, I don't know how to transition from mental health into the long-term damage from COVID, because this is probably the most depressing part of this podcast. I know. Like I want to be able to transition gracefully. There's no graceful transition. So let's just dig into this last piece. Here's the really bad news. That's not a good way to do it either, is it? Because of the way that this virus is infecting our bodies, because of the cell types that are being affected, because of the way that the immune system is acting and sometimes overacting, right? So we know that what's driving the critical cases is sort of like an immune overactivation. There's the potential for organ damage that is really important for us to understand in terms of the epidemiology, right? So who's at risk, and what to do about it. And so I really want to bring this to everyone's attention. The most concerning is the possible cardiac damage. And the reason why this is the most concerning is, unlike the other sort of long-term challenges due to organ damage from COVID, some of the studies, granted, they're still in relatively small numbers of patients. And so we'll understand this better once we're looking at more patients. But it shows that this is something that happens independent of the severity of the disease. So there was a study out of Germany that included 100 patients who were recently recovered from COVID. Of those patients, 53 were male. The mean age was 49. The mean interval between their diagnosis and when they were being evaluated was 71 days. Out of those 100 patients, 67 were completely recovered at home, and 33 required hospitalization. So that's the cross section. And what they did was they did magnetic resonance imaging, MRI, of their hearts. And what they found was that there was cardiac involvement. So they found abnormalities in 78 out of the 100 patients, with ongoing myocardial inflammation in 60.
78 out of 100? Those are not good odds.
No. And actually, you know, there's been stories of, right, from the Major League Baseball League of, people having very, you know, those athletes having very mild COVID and then having to drop out of the season because of myocarditis. What they were able to show was that there was no correlation, or this was independent of pre-existing conditions, severity and overall course of the acute illness, and the time from the original diagnosis in their patients. I mean, granted, the most they looked out from original diagnosis was 92 days, but this is showing heart damage in a very large fraction of patients. I mean, these were all symptomatic patients, so we don't know if this is happening in asymptomatic people. And there have been some interesting studies that have shown that we have these cells in our bone marrow that make clotting factors. And there's been some autopsy reports that have shown these cells are leaving the bone marrow during COVID and going all over our body and then creating clotting factors that are causing these microclots. That's research that still needs to be, you know, expanded on and better understood. But it doesn't, you know, it doesn't seem to be the same way that, you know, for example, influenza also has a fairly high, not this kind of high, but a fairly high rate of cardiac inflammation. It's nowhere near this ballpark. But we do see, right, cardiac inflammation as a result of viral infections in other types of viruses. But there seems to be something else going on here that might be related to the microclots that COVID can cause. And so this is, you know, of all the potential long-term damage from COVID, this is the most concerning because it implies, you know, maybe it's no, maybe this is, you know, it's 100 patients. So depending on how this is sampled, right, this needs to be confirmed for us to understand it. Maybe they're way over, and maybe it's only 10% of patients, right? It's like this, once we have way more data, maybe we'll understand that this is, they're overrepresented in this sample population. That's totally possible. But even if it's 10%, even if it's 1%, given the 40-ish million people globally who have had COVID so far, it implies a very high rate of potential future cardiovascular disease that is a direct result of what's happening during the COVID infection in the heart and elsewhere, right, in the body. So this is something that definitely needs to be understood better. But I bring it up again, not to spiral our entire listener base into a deep depression, but because I think it's really important to understand that this isn't just about whether or not you live or die, or whether or not you have to be hospitalized. There is the possibility here that still needs to be fully understood of long-term complications as the result of COVID-19 that have huge implications for the population at large because of how many people are getting infected. And it is yet another reason why the idea of natural herd immunity, right? Like we control the level of infection so that hospitals aren't overwhelmed and we just kind of let everybody get this naturally. Not only is that going to result in a really unacceptable number of people dying, but then we've got this whole other piece of it of what would be considered morbidity, right? Rather than mortality, that potentially has long-term implications for health of a very large number of people. So this is really important to know and understand, and data to have in your back pocket when you get into those difficult conversations with somebody who doesn't want to wear their mask or whatever it is. The cardiac damage out of all of these sort of long-term damage pieces, this is the one that is happening even in moderate cases, so symptomatic but not requiring hospitalization. There are other things that have come up now that is definitely associated with more severe infection. So, for example, kidney damage has been seen in severe infection, and up to about 25% of the critically ill patients are experiencing acute kidney injury. That's especially in people with underlying comorbidities. So that is something that is, again, sort of at least it is only happening in people who are critically ill, but it's one of the major complications that is complicating treatment for those people. So some of them are not just requiring a ventilator, but also dialysis. There's also the possibility for long-term lung damage. So this can be scar tissue building up in the lungs that can lead to long-term breathing problems. There was a study out of Austria that showed that the lungs were healing sort of slowly with time. They showed 88% of this was people who were hospitalized, but what would be considered severe illness requiring hospitalization. 88% of people had visible lung damage in scans 6 weeks after being discharged from hospital, but by 12 weeks they were down to 56%. So, I mean, the lungs are healing, but that's a small process. Smokers are certainly, you know, more likely to have lungs that are going to scar as a result. And definitely the more severe the disease, the more long-term impact there is on the lungs. There's a number of studies now that have sort of shown that there's a long tail for these more severe cases of shortness of breath being the most common, but long, you know, coughs lasting 12 weeks. If the infection is severe enough to cause shortness of breath, there's a long tail in terms of the lungs recovering, because the lungs are really, they're really delicate. They do not like to be full of inflammation. So that's what's causing this. There's also, though, now a lot more studies showing that there's brain involvement.
Smart Cookie gave us a heads up on that?
Well, so what's interesting is that it's still up for debate. There have been some studies that have shown that neurons can get infected, but it's not actually known whether or not COVID is crossing the blood-brain barrier. So even though we know in a petri dish that neurons can be infected, we don't actually know if it's the direct effects of the virus in the central nervous system, or if it's from hyperinflammation, because we know once those microglial cells in the brains are turned on, they do not turn off very easily, and they can cause all kinds of inflammatory shenanigans in the brain. We don't know if it's, right, the cytokine response, or, again, microclots. So it could be causing, I mean, these microclots are smaller than what would cause a mini stroke, for example. And there's also Guillain-Barré syndrome, which is a autoimmune disease that could potentially be driving some of this. And we've seen this in even young people that COVID-19 can cause strokes and seizures and Guillain-Barré syndrome. And so the research is mounting that there is the possibility of like severe impact on the brain, right, is where a stroke or seizures would fall. But we also know, right, there's a strong now acknowledgement of neurological symptoms, right? So like brain fog, memory deficits, cognition deficits, that is occurring during infection. And like, I have not talked to a single person who's had it who has not experienced brain fog during the infection. So it's about time that this is acknowledged as symptoms of infection. And for some people, it's the first symptom of infection. And Stacey, I think that, you know, you would probably say fatigue or brain fog were your first symptoms, wouldn't you?
Yes. I didn't realize that brain fog was a symptom until I had fatigue. Because, you know, sometimes you're just like, gosh, what's wrong with me? Or I'm so tired. Or, you know what I mean? Like,
have another coffee.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. But it was my first before fatigue. Yes.
Yeah. So neurological symptoms are certainly part of the disease. The most likely explanation for that is inflammation rather than, you know, there's not a ton of viruses that can cross the blood-brain barrier. But we don't, you know, we still don't really know. That's still an open question with COVID-19. And those types of neurological symptoms can be explained by the cytokine response, the inflammatory responses, and by microclots. So the mechanism here is still something that needs to be figured out. But there's also now been some research showing that COVID-19 may increase the risk of developing Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease. They're showing that it exacerbates those disease activity, but there's some researchers who are actually, you know, predicting now that one of the long-term effects of COVID-19 may be an increased risk of Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. So that's another, not as much data on that, obviously, as the cardiac involvement, but just like another piece of the puzzle of, you know, this virus is really the perfect storm of bad, right? The fact that it is so contagious, right? So we now have broad acknowledgement of the fact that it spreads by aerosols. And that is problematic. That's why indoor environments are so much worse than outdoor environments. Not that outdoor environments are safe, but that if you had all the same conditions, same person infected with same viral load, same distance apart, and you put them in an indoor environment, they are 20 times more likely to spread than if you had everything else the same and you put them in an outdoor environment. And by the way, right, that 5% chance is not zero. It doesn't mean that it's zero outside. It's just, you know, 5% of what it is inside. And there are examples now of super spreader events outside.
Right. So hugging and kissing and shaking hands outside is not helping.
Still no bueno. And so, you know, this virus is, you know, the reason why it is so bad, the reason why this is, you know, something that we haven't seen in 100 years, is that this asymptomatic and presymptomatic spread is making it really hard to control. The fact that there is this potential really long tail of infection is making it really challenging. It has a very high morbidity rate, a not high enough mortality rate that it'll die out, but a high enough to cause horrible outcomes for us. And you know, as we're recording this, there's over 210,000 people who have died in America alone. And over 1 million in the world. So it's in part because you go all the way from person shedding virus and being contagious who has no idea that they're sick because they feel absolutely fine, all the way to critically ill, and you have everything in between. And then you have this possibility for long-term damage. And with a virus that is novel, right? Something that we've never seen before. The studies show that having had coronavirus common colds recently, As much as the antibodies cross-react, it doesn't actually appear to protect us from infection. And so, you know, it's just this, again, it's like every single aspect of the virology, the epidemiology, and the morbidity and mortality of this virus is like the worst case scenario. That is really what we're talking about. So I want to bring it back to action items, because I know that this is, again, it's not a cheery podcast. But I think it's really important to center ourselves on, it's really important to keep doing these things. So it's really important to wear a mask, to wash hands properly, right? So that's a whole 30-second commitment, and prudently, right? So prudently means when you come in from outside of the house, before eating and after using the restroom or bathroom or washroom, depending on what country you're in. And then socially distance, avoid crowds, and avoid indoor gatherings. It's really important to know that because of the spread through aerosol. So what an aerosol is compared to a respiratory droplet is just a really small respiratory droplet. And when you talk loudly, you produce more of these really small droplets that are either aerosols or slightly bigger than aerosols. But basically, the smaller the droplet, the less gravity can work on it because it doesn't weigh as much. So it can float in the air for potentially hours. And what we didn't know until recently is whether or not those really small droplets, those can actually hold enough virus to be infectious. So we still don't really know like how many viral particles is a minimum dose for us to get this virus and what the other factors are in. And what the question is like, if you're talking about aerosols, which can travel a lot more than 6 feet, especially indoors, can that aerosol even hold enough viral particles from somebody who's infected to be relevant? And the answer now is yes. Yes, it can. And what happens in an indoor environment where there's not good airflow is as somebody's talking, hanging out, shedding virus, the aerosols are hanging out in the air and they're concentrating over time. And so it's making that air even, you know, providing an even bigger inoculating dose of virus the longer you're spending with that infected person in that indoor environment. And there are some scientists who have modeled what is the appropriate social distance to maintain in an indoor environment with poor airflow. And it's not 6 feet, it's 30 feet. And so, you know, that's why masks are so important. So if you think about masks, there's two ways that masks are working. So one is through filtering respiratory droplets. And do note that it really needs to be a tight weave fabric. So these sports weave fabrics are actually potentially breaking up respiratory droplets into aerosols as you're breathing out through them. So make sure it's at least two layers, three is better, of a tight weave fabric, like one layer of cotton and one layer of something else, like a tight weave linen or silk. That's really important. So what that mask does is it filters. Some of them are good enough to filter as well as a surgical mask. So you're talking about 95% of the respiratory droplets. But even if you go, okay, let's say 10%, because the math is easy with 10%. If I'm wearing a mask and I'm the one who's infected, only 10% of my respiratory droplets are making it through the mask. The person beside me who's not infected, if they're not wearing a mask, they're still getting 10% of my respiratory droplets in their face. If they're also wearing a mask that's also 90%, Now you're taking 90% of 10%. That's 1%, and maybe that's a low enough dose that it's not actually an infectious dose. And actually, if we're both wearing masks that are 95%, 96%, now we're talking about a fraction of a percent making it through. And that's why everyone wearing masks is really important. You're protecting others from you, but you're also protecting yourself from others. And it's the double layer of masks that is really important. But there's a second way that masks are working.
Before we move on from that, can I just emphasize, I don't often get out and about. I intentionally limit my exposure and stay home. But while we were actively fostering, I was getting out more simply from the nature of needing to do so.
Yeah.
And I noticed that I would say 75% of people are not wearing a properly fitted mask. It was shocking to me at how many people had masks coming down on their nose, or who had large gapping around the sides or the bottom. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to emphasize, like, those numbers that you gave, reducing something to potentially less than 1%
properly fitted mask.
Is a properly fitted mask. And there are so many people on Etsy or, you know, like, whoever who can help you get one that works for you. There's different brands for adjustment, whatever. Like, Wesley has a very small face. And so even just getting like a young child's mask wasn't good enough for him. We had to get him like a toddler mask. Mm-hmm. And I just,
cute.
It is, poor kid, but Matt and I don't get it, 'cause both of us have really big heads. So we're like, okay. Anyway, I just wanted to emphasize that because, I actually wrote like a blog post as it related to maskne. And when I was doing that, I was doing the research like you and I have done on the previous COVID show about effective mask use. And I was looking into type of masks, and cotton, like you said, like multiple layers of cotton can be almost just as effective
as an N95.
Yes, as you've an N95.
Three layers, yeah.
If it is properly fitted. And I'm just like, it's such a simple thing. And I know that it's not, you know, right in front of you all the time, but like, maybe just put it in your calendar right now to tonight after dinner to research and find yourself or your family or whoever like good fitted mask. Because the other thing too is it's more comfortable. Like it's annoying to wear a mask that doesn't fit right and that you're constantly having to pull at, or you know what I mean? Like I just wanted to take the time to say that because I think it's important to understand why this is so effective and how effective it can be, but also like just don't, as we say in our house, don't 80% it. And not get a properly fitted mask, because then it undoes all that benefit that you just described.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you for emphasizing that. I will say my favorite masks are the homemade ones. And I am not a competent sewer, but I did sew myself a mask. And then I asked my mom to make me 30. So my mom made most of them. So if you have a mother who sews,
we all need Sarah's mom in our life.
I will make sure that the pattern that I used, that my mom also used, gets into the show notes because it worked really well. But I also bought masks from Amazon that were made by Fruit of the Loom. Now, they're kind of like wearing tidy whities on your face. I will completely admit that. But we took fabric markers to them and made them really fun by drawing giant smiley faces on them. And though they're quite comfortable, and they were very inexpensive. So I'll make sure again that a link to that goes in the show notes. And then I was able also from Amazon able to get nose pieces that have a little that they're like peel and stick that you could put onto any mask. If your mask has a nose piece pocket, these little nose pieces, I mean, I've got them in some masks where they've gone through the washing machine probably 20 times now, and they're still doing great. If you're using the adhesive, they're good for about 2 wears, but they're also very inexpensive. So again, 3 things that I'll make sure that there's links in the show notes for people. But I do think that the homemade mask that is, you know, the right size for your face is definitely the best option if you're crafty yourself, or if you have anyone in your life who's crafty. Or again, Etsy is a great source for people. There's, you know, people whose entire livelihoods now is making masks and selling them on Etsy. And I think they're wonderful. It's wonderful to support those people doing such a great thing. So please make sure that your mask fits. It should be comfortable. It shouldn't be tight enough to leave marks in your face. But it should be against your skin all the way around your nose and mouth. So it should be fitting over the bridge of your nose, fitting, you know, touching your skin down your cheeks, and as well as either along your jawline or under your chin. And that's really important because there's this other whole way that masks work. So it's not just the filtering ability, but it also stops how far respiratory droplets can go. And this is actually maybe more important. So think about, a regular respiratory droplet can go about 4 to 5 feet, which is why 6 feet is this social distance that we're, ideally going to maintain, because we're sort of beyond the reach of a normal respiratory droplet, not talking about aerosols. But when you wear a mask, it actually blocks the airflow. So there have been studies that have basically like hooked different homemade masks up to rigs and kind of shown that if there's no mask, that, they sort of blow like little respiratory droplets that are colored to look, or smoke, right? That sort of looks like how far something would breathe out if you're breathing out. No mask, it can go 6 feet. Mask on, depending on the mask, you're talking 2 to 3 inches. So now if you combine two masks with that filtration efficiency, and then also your social distance, suddenly now we're asymptoting towards zero. And so that is why masks are so phenomenally effective. They are right now our most effective tool at controlling the spread of COVID. And I will tell you, we can link to my blog post on it where I go through the science on hypercapnia and hypoxia. There have been studies looking at N95 use in people with COPD on treadmills and have shown that it's not causing hypoxia and hypercapnia. So that is a myth. And it is, I recognize that we're not a culture where masks were common up until now. And they take some getting used to. They can feel hot and uncomfortable. I recognize that. I wear a mask to walk my dog. And even if I'm powering up a steep hill, I recognize that it's strange to wear a mask, but I do want to encourage, if any of our listeners are not wearing masks, especially when, maintaining social distance, it should be at all times indoors if you're outside of your home. And outside when you cannot maintain social distance. And so I will encourage you to give yourself the opportunity to get used to it. I found when I started wearing masks daily for walking the dog that it was about 5 dog walks, which was, we walk the dog twice a day. So it was like 2.5 walks. And by the fifth one, I was like, oh, it's okay. I got it. I'm like starting to forget that I have it on. That might be, you might adjust faster or slower, but it really is our number one best tool. And it really is a shame that it's something that's become politicized.
Was there a mic drop there? I was just waiting for the, I just want to emphasize that. I think I've been feeling a lot of certain feels, especially this week, seeing so many people that we're used to seeing on TV become infected. And it's bringing about like all this like residual emotions in me that I hadn't really had to face in a long time. And it's not political. Like, compassion is not political. Science is not political. And it's difficult because you and I care so deeply about the health and well-being and safety of our listener base and the entire world. That has always been our message for as long as we've been doing this show. Yeah. It's difficult to think that it's become something other than that. But I just want to emphasize, like, we have been and always will be, whether masking is quote unquote political, like, that's not what we're here to do. We're here to tell you what the science says. We're here to tell you how to maximize your wellness, your health, and your safety in a way that you can control. And we've always fully admitted that lifestyle is not always controlled by, you could do everything right. And, things can still happen, whether it's with your own personal health or with others. And so, It's been emotional for me, and I don't know, I'm sure it's emotional for everyone, but I think for me, especially, just to be revisiting symptoms that I'd forgotten about, or, you know what I mean? Like, oh, I remember mm-hmm. that, or just, things that haven't had to deal with. And I think we've all as a community have a lot of anxiety about getting this. Sarah, you and I have talked about it, right? Like of whether you're avoiding it and concerned about what might happen to you or loved ones. If you're part of the 5 to 10% who has a morbidity rate from contracting it, I think that's accurate. Mm-hmm. Correct me if I'm wrong. But I think furthermore, you know, even when you do have it, like I mentioned earlier, that anxiety and stress doesn't go away. And it, you know, you still worry about your loved ones and you worry about other people, and it's hard. And so I guess I'm just kind of wrapping it up with, this is not an easy show, especially for me to hear about some of these things. But it's so important as we continue to learn and grow together. And I just want to encourage us all to have compassion. And I appreciate our listeners who value the science and who are making educated decisions about the health and well-being, not just of themselves, but those around you. We know it's not easy. We know it's not what we all want to do, but your efforts are appreciated. And I just want to thank our listeners for making it this far into our very long show.
I think the most important message that we can communicate is that we are all in this together. And even if we're socially distanced, that doesn't mean socially isolated. And I just want to express my gratitude to our community for, valuing the science and being engaged with this, because the more people that we can get to follow the science and take meaningful action, even though it requires self-sacrifice, I think that's it. I mean, the data is unequivocal. That's our path to normalcy, and so I want to thank our listeners and apologize for a kind of a bad news show.
We will be sharing more about what we really think over on our Patreon. We are caught up and no longer doing those long shows. As Sarah said, we realized that it really wasn't to our benefit or your benefit to do them that way. So going forward, you'll be able to hop on over if you're part of our Patreon family and listen to the follow-on unfiltered version of our thoughts as we recap each show. So you can find the link and information on that in our show notes, or you can just search us up on Patreon. Thank you so much for being here, hanging through, and being a part of this wonderful community. We so appreciate.
Thanks for listening. I'll be back next week with something happier to talk about. Do you love the Whole View podcast? We'd love for you to leave us a review wherever you listen and share a podcast with your friends and family.
And did you know that you can now get exclusive behind-the-scenes content on Patreon for less than the price of an almond milk matcha a month? Your Patreon membership supports us and gets you access to a monthly bonus episode.
But not for kids' ears, because our bonus content is explicit. You can find us as The Whole View on Patreon for our real, unfiltered thoughts on this week's episode. So, in Red Bank, which is, I've actually been there. I've been to Red Bank, New Jersey. I even went to the comic book store there.
Red Bank, New Jersey, like all the rest of New Jersey, is the armpit of America. And if Matt uses that in the bloopers, Jersey, I love you, but you know you're the armpit of America, right? I told my kids if they ever moved to Jersey, I wouldn't visit them. Have I told you this? I feel like I've told you this before.
Wait. Okay, so my big question here that's really, really important. Is New Jersey the only state that you have said this about? Yes. Are there other states that you would be like, okay, New Jersey, but also South Dakota? Or not? I just picked that at random.
Been to Michigan. I could see Michigan as maybe being the other armpit. Like that, you know. I'm not
You've never been to Michigan?
I don't think so.
Like Detroit?
I've never
been
there.
Ann Arbor?
Yeah, no. I've heard wonderful things about like Ann Arbor, Kalamazoo. My brother-in-law went to college there. But I could see how like Detroit could be the other armpit. Because the reason that I say it is because it's just like so stinky and manufacturing and like, you know what I mean? Like,
did you know that I ran the Detroit Marathon in 2001?
No.
I bet you did not know that.
No.
And it was the fall right after 9/11. I think it was like the next month. And normally the Detroit Marathon would go across the bridge into Canada. It was an international marathon and you would run half of it in Detroit and half of it in, I guess it's Chatham right there. And, that was the first year that it was, they changed the route to make it 100% in Detroit because borders were dodgy back then. So my entire experience of Detroit is running for 4 hours through it.
That's pretty significant experience. Like I'm sure you saw a lot that way.
It was beautiful. I liked it. And I mean, there was even like part of that, we stayed near the stadium, which was like supposed to be a bad end of town. Everyone was telling me like beforehand, it was really scary. And I didn't think it was, I was like,
I mean, I'm sure
it's
if
fine.
You go back, you won't like it much.
But
like I've been to Chicago and I think Chicago's a wonderful place. You and I have both been all mm-hmm. over Chicago.
Yeah.
So no, I haven't said it about any other place.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And right. I think also because I have people who I know very well who live in Jersey, and I know that there aren't other nicer places of Jersey, but like it's just kind of a joke and they laugh and they're like, yeah, you're not wrong. I mean, it's like when you're driving into New York City, like you just drive through the worst part of it, you know? And so I like joked because the boys and I have driven to New York City several times, and every time we do and we're driving through that part of Jersey, I'm like, we're not stopping. Like, we're going.
So I've only been to Red Bank, New Jersey. We had really good friends who got married there. And Red Bank was beautiful. Like, I thought, like, we got lost on our way there. And what the thing that I most remember is it's like tiny little town, tiny little town. Like, it just feels like it's one solid little town. And I just remember it being, like, really quaint. Like, it was – and, like, Red Bank itself, we went to the comic book store that like is in all the Jay and Silent Bob movies. Cause that's like a real comic book store in Red Bank, New Jersey. And I bought a toque there that said, what is the thing that Jay always says? Wait. Smoogum? Wait, what is it, the thing that he says? Matt, help me here.
Matt's not here. I can't help you, but I do think that it's something close to that. The question I have is, did you go to Red Bank for the purpose of going to that comic book store?
Smoochie? No, he doesn't say Smoochie. It's like Snoogum.
Are you Googling it? Because you just
I am
lost your
totally
cool card.
Googling it. What is the thing he says? I'm gonna have to go find the hat. No, we went for a wedding and then the comic book store was like a fun thing to do the next day.
Yeah, for sure. You gotta go.
Yeah.
The other thing
Snoogans.
I do, okay. Yeah.
Snoogans.
And no one cheers.
And you can buy the Snoogans winter hat that I have at jayandsilentbob.com.
And nobody goes. I will say the other good thing about New Jersey is they have this gluten-free bakery right outside the city that we always stop at on our way into the city. So technically we do enter Jersey and we do stop, but only to go to Plum and Montclair, and then we get right back in our car and we leave right away.